Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Samachem with Aleph, seven lines down. Amar Abaye. Haiman, the Mosik Zuze Derevita Bechavre, an individual who is a creditor to his friend, but he's not a creditor for the principal amount of the loan, but this is the interest payment that was owed. So it's an illegal transaction. He's not allowed to collect the interest, but nevertheless, he is collecting the interest as a lender. In the shuk, the going market price at this point is 4 sa'ah to the zuz. And this guy gives him 5 sa'ah to the zuz. So now, the creditor is owed money from the debtor. Again, not the principal amount, but the interest payment that he illegally charged him for. So instead of paying him in money, he pays him in wheat. But when he pays him in wheat, he doesn't pay him the market price. He actually discounts the market price and gives him more than he deserves based on the market price. So here the debtor is giving him more than the already problematic payment that he's getting, which is the interest payment. So he's paying in excess of the interest payment because of the fact that he's giving him extra. So if he gets brought to court, where we're going to extract the interest because it wasn't proper for him to collect interest over here. And we'll see later in today's daf that we paskin like Rabbi Elazar that when there's ribit ktsutza, when you have ribit d'oraita, we do extract it in court. If the court comes, it'll enforce the fact that you're not allowed to collect interest and force you to repay the money, disgorge the profits. The question about the remedy is now, ki mafkinim minei, arba'a mafkinim minei. Abaye says, if we cause him to disgorge the profits, if the court interferes here and says you got to repay the interest because it was an illegal payment, so the creditor must refund that to the debtor. And again, as we discussed earlier, whether the court can act on its own or does it need a toveya, it needs a claimant to come in and bring the case so the court can interfere. But here the court is exercising its right to force him to disgorge the profits. Abaye says that he only has to disgorge the profits that are specifically associated with the interest payment. Idach, ozulehu dukamozul gabe. The rest is a discount that he gave him. The rest is, in a sense, a gift that he's giving him. Here, just for an example, just say that he owes him 1 zuz worth of interest. So if he had gone into the shuk and paid him in kind, he should have handed him 4 sa'ah worth of chitim. Instead, he handed him 5 sa'ah of chitim. That extra sa'ah of chitim that he gave him is not necessarily associated with the interest payment because as far as the interest payment is concerned, he only deserved 4 sa'ah. The additional sa'ah he gets, Abaye claims, is not associated with the interest payment and therefore he gets to keep it. So he only has to disgorge 4 sa'ah. He does not have to disgorge the 5th sa'ah because that 5th sa'ah was just a discount that he got in the market. Rav Amar, Chamisha mafkinen minei. Rava says you have to disgorge the entire amount. Not just the 4 sa'ah, but even the 5 sa'ah. Demikara, betorat revita atai liyadei. Because it's part of a package of interest, and that's how it came into his possession. Meaning that his ability to garner a discount in the market is facilitated by the fact that he's collecting an interest payment. The only reason he got 5 sa'ah is because he got the first 4 sa'ah. The first 4 sa'ah are associated with the interest payment. So the 5th sa'ah that he garners as a bonus is a bonus on interest. And a bonus on interest is deemed to be interest as well. And therefore now he's got to disgorge the entire 5 sa'ah, not just the 4 sa'ah that are associated with the interest payment. V'amar Abaye, a similar situation. Ha'iman d'masik arba'a zuzei d'revita b'chavrei. A creditor who is collecting 4 zuz worth of interest from his friend. And not only does he pay him the interest, in addition to the interest, he hands him a cloak as well. So besides the interest payment that he's making him, he's giving him, in addition to that, a cloak. Abaye, consistent with his position, says, when we cause him to disgorge the interest or the profits here, we force him to give back the 4 zuz, which are associated with the interest payment, and we assume that the cloak was a gift, and that he can keep, because that wasn't part of the interest payments. It was in excess of what he owed in terms of interest, and therefore we view that as a matana, and the interest payments as being illegal profits that he has to disgorge. So Rav Amar, glima mafkinen minet. Rava says he has to not only disgorge the cash payment of interest, but also the cloak. My taima. What's the reason behind Rava? So people don't say, glima de michse bikaye, the cloak that this guy is wearing and carrying around, glima de revito, is a cloak of interest. Rava's statement over here seems to imply that Mikar Adin, he does not necessarily argue with Abaye. That it's not that legally he has to disgorge the cloak. Our problem is the optics of it or the association that people will make that the cloak came as part of or in tandem with an interest payment. People will naturally associate it with an interest payment. And so therefore they're going to say when he's walking around, this guy's walking around with a cloak of interest. And that we don't want. We want people to understand that interest is not acceptable. Therefore, we make him to disgorge it. You could argue that this is Me'ikar Adin. What Rava is pointing out is that people, by associating the cloak with the interest payment, tell you what the cloak is. This is along the lines of what you're suggesting, that if it comes with the money, then it's just more of the same. It is interest. And you could argue that Me'ikar Adin, Rava is saying that because people associate the two together, that makes it that the cloak is an additional interest payment, not just a gift. So Amar Rava, so now we have a third case. Ha'iman the Musik Tresar Zuzei Derevita Bechavre. Again, here a creditor who is collecting or looking to collect 12 zuz worth of interest. By the way, it's going up so far. We had the first case where it sounded like a zuz. Then 4 zuz, and now we're up to 12 zuz worth of interest. And then he rents from the debtor an area, a chatzer, that normally goes for 10 zuz. The debtor overcharges him and says that it's going to cost you 12 per year. So everything goes around. He's charging him interest illegally, and so the other guy feels justified in charging him a higher premium for the location that he's going to rent. So the creditor is accepting interest payments or demanding interest payments. The debtor, in lieu of paying the interest payment, is renting him his property. But when he rents him the property, he's doing it at a premium to the market price. Then, when we come and force him to disgorge the interest profits, we force him to disgorge the 12. So even though he accepted something worth 10 for the payment of 12 that he deserves, we don't say, oh, the real value of what you took was only 10. We say, no, you took it in lieu of a 12 zuz payment. So even though in sense he only receives 10 zuz out of his 12 zuz worth of value because he accepted a property at a higher value than it really was, nevertheless, when we force him to disgorge the interest, we force him to disgorge the full 12. So Amale Rav Acha Midifti the Ravina, the Lemele. Why doesn't the creditor say, Ki Agra Hochi Dahava Hakamishtar Shili? When I rented it at the premium price, that's because I had profits in hand. Hashadolo Mishtar Shili, Ki the Agra Kuli Alma Hu the Garna. If I didn't have that profit in hand, I would have rented it at the market price. What he is saying is that people are more apt to take profits and be less careful about what they do with their profits. That means that the principal amount, people are careful. But if they have some sort of windfall from the principal amount, which we'll look at the interest payment here as some sort of windfall, then that windfall, they're willing to spend it a little more loosely. People say that I'll let the profits ride. There are other expressions or colloquial expressions that give articulation to what he's saying here. But in essence, he says, I had 12 extra zuz because I was collecting this interest payment. And therefore, I was willing to spend them a little more loosely, even though the thing was only worth 10. I'm willing to give you a bonus and take it for 10 in place of 12 because you're the one paying me the 12 anyway, number one. And number two is it's a profit. Ravina responds to him, or the reasoning behind Rava is, Mishum Damale, Savar Tvikavot. You accepted it, meaning that once you've accepted the in-kind payment or in-lieu payment, then that becomes the market value of what you're receiving, even though technically the market price is otherwise, and the circumstances or the context made you more apt to accept something that was above market. Nevertheless, once you accepted it, that becomes the value of what you're receiving. You're expecting to receive 12. You accepted this as the payment or in lieu of the 12, and therefore it's worth 12, and you've got to disgorge those profits of 12. So again, here you have a series of cases in which the creditor is going to collect interest. In the first two scenarios, the debtor pays him the interest payment plus. And in both of those cases, Abaye says he just has to disgorge the interest, not the plus. Rava says he has to disgorge the profits and the plus. In the first case where it's all based on the money, there it's much more closely associated. The only reason he's giving him in the first case 5 sa'ah instead of 4 sa'ah is because he's using the interest payment to garner whatever it is that he's purchasing. So over there, you can understand Rava more clearly because there he is getting more just for the interest payment. In lieu of the interest payment, the debtor is giving him more chita. And so there, it can clearly be or associated with the interest payment. Rava extends that even when it's a glima, it's something completely separate from the interest payment. He still says the two are associated together. And then in the final case, Rava says that even in a scenario where the creditor is accepting something for the debtor in lieu of his payment and is accepting it at a premium rate, nevertheless, since he equated the interest payment with the benefit he's receiving from the debtor, that becomes the value of what he's receiving, and he'll have to disgorge that value. Even though on a market basis, he only accepted something worth 10, but he accepted it for the payment of 12. And so that final case where the creditor is going to collect interest and instead of collecting interest, he lives for free, rent free in the debtor's property and deducts the interest payment. Even though he's doing that at a premium price, he still has to disgorge all those profits because they are associated with the interest payment. Now, in terms of Abaye and Rava's machloket over here, you can look at it as a very local machloket, which is a question about ribit. When we talk about interest, how far are the reaches of interest? The body looks at interest as being simply the interest payment. Anything surrounding it is independent of the interest payment. And Rava says anything associated with the interest payment is interest, even though it technically might be separate or in excess of what he owes him. The other hand, you could argue that it is connected to their machloket as to whether when someone violates an isur in the Torah, how successful are they at violating the isur? So machloket de Abaye and Rava, as to whether when you violate an isur in the Torah, you are successful at taking the action, but you're in violation of the isur HaTorah, or the Torah prevents you from even having that action be efficacious at all. And so if you're doing something against the Torah, it's as if you did nothing. So over here too, you could argue here where you're making an interest payment is illegal. When you make an interest payment that is illegal, how do we view that? Do we view that you have a kinyan on the money, but you did something wrong? Or do we view it that you are basically in the possession of this money illegally because you can't make a kinyan on this money? You took it against the instructions of the Torah. And so some want to associate the machloket here between Abaye and Rava with their machloket as to whether you are successful at violating an isur HaTorah and as to whether how much of what you received here really belongs to you, but you're in violation of an isur, or does it not belong to you whatsoever, and therefore it's not really yours to start with, and therefore you'd have to disgorge everything. Anyway, it's a machloket, the Abaye and Rava, and other places you could associate those two, although it seems here that the machloket seems to be much more local about the reaches of interest, or maybe even how much we penalize someone who takes an interest payment. Is it just the absolute interest payment that we penalize, or anything associated with the interest payment? Okay, next Mishnah. Marbin ala schar, ve'in marbin ala mecher. You're allowed to increase the cost when it has to do with rent or wages, but you can't do it when it comes to a sale. Ketzad, hiskir lo et chatzero. If he rents out his property to him, v'amarlo, and he says to him, imi achshav, atano tainli, if you prepay me for the whole year, hariluchha be'eser slaim l'shana, then I'll charge you 10 selah for the whole year. V'im shel chodesh b'chodesh, if you pay on a monthly basis, selah l'chodesh. You pay me 1 selah per chodesh, mutar. That is fine. So his essence, I mean, if we look at this from an optical standpoint, he's basically saying to him, if you pay as you go, then you pay 12 selah for the whole year, because it's a selah per month. If you prepay the whole thing, then it is 10 selah for the whole year. So, in essence, what he's saying to him is, if you give me the money up front, then I am deducting from the price. So that could be one of two things. You can either argue that he is giving him a cheaper rate and that he is reducing the value of the merchandise. He's basically giving him a discount. Or you could say that he's actually paying interest here. Because he says, if you give me and lend me the money up front, instead of giving it as it goes along and as it becomes due, I'll pay you basically two sella worth of interest for lending me the money until you would have paid later. So here the Mishnah says, this is viewed as a discount on the price and not as interest. Macharlo et sadeyu, on the other hand, if he sells him his field, v'amarlo im miachshav ata noten li, if you pay me immediately for the sale of the field, harishalcha be'elav zuz, then it's 1,000 zuz. Im legoren, if you don't pay me for the sale until the time of the threshing, meaning the harvest time, b'shneimasar maneh, then it's 12,100 or 1,200 asur. Then it's problematic. Now, here again, it seems like the exact same case. If you pay me up front, it's 1,000. You pay me in the back end, it's 1,200. So again, here you can view it either as a discount on the price, or is it an interest payment for the delay of paying what you're supposed to pay? If you give me the cash now, I'll give you 200 for lending me the money until you would have paid later. Or if you pay me later, then you pay the 1,200 for the fact that I am allowing you to not pay for that period of time. So here the Mishnah says it's asur. So clear that there's a difference, some sort of chiluk that you have to make between the first part of the Mishnah and the second part of the Mishnah. But in one case, the Mishnah says mutar. The other case, it's asur. And that's summarized by the first line of the Mishnah, which is marbin al eschar bein marbim al mecher. That you're allowed to increase the rent, but you're not allowed to increase the sale price. So maishna resha o maishna seifa. So the Gemara asks right off the bat, what's the difference between the resha and the seifa? It seems to be an identical case. So Rabbi Rav Yosef Darmei Tovayu, schirut en mishtalemet ela basof. Schirut only comes due at the end. Hi, kevin delo mata zimne, the migva. Here, therefore, the landlord, since it hasn't come time for him to collect, lav agar natarle. Therefore, he's not paying him for the delay or for the ability to borrow the money. Mishvahu d'hachashavyo. This is its true value. V'hai d'kamerle im miachshav atanotainli. And then when he says to him, if you pay me immediately, hayriluchha be'eser slaim l'shana, you can pay 10 for the whole year, ozulehu d'kam mozil gabay. That's because he is discounting the price for him. So now, what is happening here? And Tosafot actually makes this clear, which is that when we say schirut einu mishtalemet el basof, there is a machloket other places in Shas as to whether schirut is only comes due at the last moment, meaning when you complete whatever it is or you utilize whatever it is that is a part of the agreement, or that schirut is mitchila v'ad sof, that the rental is accrued over the whole period of time and therefore you owe as you accrue it, that's what you owe. Tosfot says, irrespective of which opinion here, both of them agree that it only comes due at the end. The only question is, how is it earned? Is it that the obligation only comes at the last moment? Or is the obligation accrued through the whole period of time? But both of them agree that you don't pay the schirut until the end. Owing of the money is only at the end of the period. And therefore he says the Gemara's statement over here is according to both opinions. It doesn't matter what you hold over here. No matter whether you believe that the schirut, the obligation is mitchila batsof, or only batsof, both of them agree that the payment, the actual cash payment, is only made at the end. And therefore, this kalocha is true according to both opinions. He just says about a poel, a worker who has a right to walk off the job in the middle of the day, if you say ain't schirut mishtalemet ela batsof, then how can he get paid if he walks off the job in the middle of the day because he never reaches the end point? The answer is that since he has a right, a poel, to walk off in the middle of the day, the sof is, whenever he decides he's done working, that becomes the sof. And at that point, the balabayit, or the employer, owes him the money. Now, based on that, what happened here is that the obligation of the renter to pay has yet to exist. He doesn't have an obligation to pay because he hasn't reached the sof yet. He hasn't reached the end. Since he has yet to be obligated in the money, he does not owe the landlord anything. If he doesn't owe the landlord anything, then when he gives him money now, the giving of the money now is not a loan in any way, or the schar hamtanat ma'ot, which means that the deferral of the payment by the landlord is not a favor to the renter. The renter has that right, irrespective of what the landlord says, because he doesn't owe the money until the rental comes to the end. And since he doesn't owe him the money, then when the landlord says to him, pay me less now up front, he's not discounting it because of the fact that he would have charged him interest for the loan. He doesn't owe the money today. He wants to give the money up front to garner a discount on the rental. So now, the way that it works is, since the landlord is owed no money currently, therefore, when the renter comes and says, I'll pay you up front, since you're under no obligation to pay today, you can't claim, if you pay as it goes, when you pay monthly, that you're paying an interest payment for paying monthly, because you didn't owe it now, to say that it's schar hamtanat ma'ot, to say that it is agar natar. On the other hand, if he owes the money up front and then says if you pay in the back end, you're going to have to pay more, that's the equivalent of charging interest. And that's what the Gemara says here. This is considered to be a discount on the price because the money's not owed till later. If you want to pay me now, I'll give you a discount. I'm not charging you interest to pay me later. I'm giving you a discount to pay me now. On the other hand, in the case of the Mecher, Seifa, Kaven de Zvine Ninhu, since the sale is already complete, the sale is complete, that means that the buyer owes him the money already. Ubay the mishkal dmei me'achshav. And he wants his money. The seller wants his money immediately. Hilkach agar notar lehu va'avsor. And therefore he says, if you pay me later and not now, I'm really charging you more. It's not that I'm discounting the price today. The truth is, if before the sale he had structured it that way, it might have worked. Because then he didn't owe him the money yet. Once he owes him the money for the sale, he can't say then, well, if you pay me then, it's $1,200. You pay me now, it is $1,000. Because then he's basically saying to him, you want to hold on to the money, you're going to pay me more. You give me the money now, you pay less. The price for the field, in essence, was already set. The only question now is, what is the cost of the money? Is the money that you're going to pay me now the value of the field? Or you're going to pay me more than the value of the field if you pay it later. So instead of viewing it now as a discount to the price, we view it as a cost for the carrying of the loan for that period of time until you repay me. So that's the difference in the Mishnah between the case where the money has yet to be owed or the obligation is yet to be outstanding. Over there, then the real price is 12 and the 10 is a discount. On the other hand, by the case of the field or the sale, there the price is set. The price is the 1,000. Now you want to pay later on, I'm increasing the price to 1,200. It's not that I'm discounting it for you to pay up front, it's rather that I'm increasing the value later on. And that's because the obligation is already outstanding, meaning that it's supposed to pay him when he buys the field. Right? The obligation exists already, and since it exists already, the delay is what's causing the increase in the price, and that's exactly what interest is. Interest is paying for a delay of repayment. Amarova doku barabonon. The Rabbanan were midayek baha milta for this issue. The issue that they're speaking about is that ain't schirut mishtalemet ela basof. Where is there a hint in the Torah, basically, that this concept of schirut is only owed at the end? Where do we derive that from the Torah? Vukumu akra, and they found a pasuk on which to lean on, which is keschir shana bishana. Like it's an employee, but schir shana bishana means that he is hired year to year. Schirut shel shana zo inu mishtalemet ela bishana acheret. So the way the Gemara reads it, what does it mean, keschir shana bishana? It means the schir, the rental, or the monies that are owed for this year, bishana acheret, are paid in the subsequent year. And that's because you only earn, or you're only entitled to the schirut for this year at the end. That means that the only time that when it's going to get paid is after the year has passed, into the next year is when you're going to get paid for it. That is because ain't schirut ela basof. So it's a diuk out of the pasuk that schirut is paid or is only owed at the end, not at the upfront. Ve'im legoren b'shnei masar mane asur. I'm Rav Nachman Tarsha Shari. If you structure it in the following manner, it is mutar. So what the Mishnah said is if you structure the sale in a manner by which the sale goes through and you say if you pay me now it's 1,000, you pay me later it's 1,200. That's considered to be rebeat and is illegal. But what Rav Nachman is trying to suggest here is that Tarsha, this type of structure, can, in a sense, we'll call it circumvent this problem, or is not problematic when you structure it in the following manner. What the meaning of the word tasha is not clear. The Ramban over here suggests that it's from the word cheresh, silent, which means that it's ribit chereshet. It is silent interest, because it's interest that does not conform to the problems of the Torah, or is not out loud interest, which you can't charge. It's a undercover interest, which is allowed. Others suggest that the word tasha means like a pinnacle or a peak, or tasha means sela, trashim, which is the Gemara uses to describe Hebron as a place of trashim, which is a very rocky area, sela, a solid place. Whatever the definition is, Rashi over here explains to us what exactly is tarsha. Tarsha shari, limkor schora, bahamtana, to sell merchandise on delayed basis, biyoter midameha, at a higher than market price. Ubelvad, shelo yifareshlo, as long as it does not explicitly say, im me'achshav, if you pay me now, harehu lecha b'pachot, then you get it for less. Ela yimkor stam, b'kach b'kach, liyom ploni. And he says, this is the price for such and such a day. So here, the market price today is X. The market price in the future is X plus. So what he says to him is, I'm selling it to you today at the X plus price. And you'll pay me the X plus price at the X plus date in the future. So what he's doing is he's selling him today, not taking cash payment for it today. The cash payment is delayed until later on. Well, now that the cash payment is delayed later on, he's also garnering a higher price for it. So now what it looks like, if you were to say to this, if you were really to articulate what's happening here, he's basically saying to him, I'm selling it to you today. If you pay me today, you don't even have to buy it from me. You could pay it from someone else. You could buy it at the X price in the market. But since you don't have cash today, and you're only going to pay me at the later date, I'm going to charge you the price at that later date, which is X plus, because you're only paying me at the X plus date. So if I was to look at this from a bird's eye view, it looks like the same thing as the case of the Mecher. But the reason it isn't is because he doesn't say. He does not offer him the two options. He doesn't say, if you pay today, this is the price. If you pay later, this is the price. He simply gives him one price, which is, if you want to buy this from me and you want to pay on that date, this is the price for that. He gives him one sale option. The sale option is that you take delivery today and you pay me at the X plus date, you're going to pay the X plus price, and that's it. Even though today's price is X, nevertheless, he can charge him the X plus price. Rav Nachman says, Tarsha Shari. That is mutar. And at the date later on, it's not clear here whether they're setting a fixed price for the later date, the X plus price is already fixed, or he's simply saying to him, you're going to pay me the market price at that date. But as we discussed yesterday, in the seasonality of the harvest, prices moved, and they basically knew for certain that prices were lower at one point and higher at one point. And he's basically saying to him, you're going to pay me at the later market price, and there's almost certainty that there will be a higher price at that point. Now, that might be part of the heter, which is that it's not absolutely certain it'll be higher then. It could be lower. And that might be actually the solution to the problem. That's why it's not problematic over here. But then you have to believe that the X plus price is the market price of that date, not a fixed X plus price. And the way Rashi's reading it is that you're going to pay me at the higher price at the later date is a fixed price. That means that is the price that you're going to pay. We're not saying that it'll be the future market price at that date. So Rav Nachman says that is mutar. Eitvei Rami Bar Chama Rav Nachman. So Rami Bar Chama asks Rav Nachman, Rami la Rav Ukva Bar Chama la Rav Nachman, Vim the Gorin B'Shnimasar Meneh Asur. Isn't that our Mishnah? Our Mishnah is pretty clear that doing such a transaction is problematic. You sold him the field today, and you're charging him a higher price in the future. That's called interest. Amalei, Hotam Katzle, Hachalo Katzle. Over there, he gave him the price, which is the cost of the field is 1,000. You want to pay me in the future, 1,200. So in the Mishnah, he's giving the market price of the field at 1,000 and saying, if you pay me later, it's 1,200. That means that you're charging him more. Here, he does not give him a price today. He simply says, the price when you want to pay is such and such. He doesn't give him the alternative to say the value today is such. And if you wait till then, you're going to pay more. He just simply gives him the higher price. He only gives them that one alternative, and therefore that becomes the value of the merchandise that he's selling, because he's only giving him that one price. All right, Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa says, Tarsha didi shari. My Tarsha is mutar. My Tarsha is not a problem of interest. My Taima. What is the reason? Shechrai lo pasid. My beer doesn't go bad. Zuze lo tzrichna. Money I don't need because I'm wealthy. Anahu de kavidna milta gabi lokeach. I'm just doing the buyers a favor. This is very interesting because what Rav Papa is saying is, I'm a beer maker and I have the ability to deliver the beer today. I don't need the cash today. I also don't need to sell the beer today. I can store the beer, wait till the time when the price goes up, which again, this is a seasonal thing, so he knows the price is going to go up. I can keep the beer won't go bad, sell it at the higher price at the later date. And to me, there's no advantage to selling it today. I don't need the cash. I have plenty of working capital. I have plenty of wealth without this. And I don't need to unload the beer because the beer is not going to go bad. So to me, I'm indifferent between waiting until the later date and selling it versus giving you the delivery of the beer today and taking payment later at that higher price. In essence, he says, I'm doing the buyers a favor. I can wait and only sell it to them at the higher price, at the higher price date, or I can do them a favor and give them the beer today and just have them pay me the higher price at the higher price date. Rav Papa over here is saying that I am garnering no benefit, and therefore my charging of the higher price is not interest, but my charging of the higher price is what I would have received anyway. And the only thing I'm doing now is a favor to the buyers that I'm giving them the beer now instead of giving it to them later when I would have sold it then. That's how Rav Papa views it. Amar Leih Rav Sheshet Brei the Ravidi Rav Papa. So Rav Sheshet Brei Ravidi says to Rav Papa, that's nice, but that's from your perspective. My Chazi Mar the Ka'azlet Batar Didach. Why are you looking at this transaction from your perspective? Zil Batar Didhu. Why don't you take a look at it from the buyer's perspective? Dilu Havalu Zuzeh. Had they had cash today, Havashakle ki hashta, they would be able to buy it in the market at the lower price. Hashta, the late lehu zuzei, now that they don't have cash, shakle ki yokra le kameh, they're being forced to pay the higher price. So from their perspective, the lack of cash makes it that they can't go into the market and buy it at today's market price. That means that you're basically charging them for the fact that they don't have cash today and you're delaying the need for the payment. You're right. From your perspective, you don't need the cash and you're indifferent. But for the buyers, there is a difference. They can't get beer in the market today because they don't have cash. That means that the delay of payment is making it that it's more expensive for them to buy the beer today. Or in essence, they're paying interest for the ability to delay the payment until the later date. So that's the Tarsha of Rav Papa, which Rav Sheshet Brei the Ravidi rejects as being a legal way to do this. Now we have Amar Rav Chama. Tarsha didi vaday shari. My tarsha, or the way that I structure it, is for sure okay. So now we have three different structures here that are being suggested. Rav Nachman, Rav Papa, and now Rav Chama's structure. My taima. Why does it work over here? Nechelo deliku bishuti. They are happy to leave it in my possession. Tocho echa deka azle shavkilu mechsa v'nakaluhu shuka. Everywhere they go, they don't charge them tax. And they give them the priority sale. So now let's understand this. Rashi has a long explanation as to what the situation or circumstance is. The first thing is that Rav Chama is a Talmud Chacham, but he's a Talmud Chacham that's obviously associated with the Reish Galuta, that is associated with the Exilarch's house. The Exilarch's house was given special priorities or special terms wherever they went. That is, first of all, they don't pay taxes. And number two is they get to sell first. Now that's both a respect and a privilege of being a part of the Reish Galuta, being part of the house of the Exilarch, especially when it comes to a Talmud Chacham who is associated with the Exilarch's house. So Rav Chama is afforded that special treatment. But not only is he afforded that special treatment, anybody who works on his behalf or is an emissary of his gets that same treatment. Again, here it's a circumstance or situation in which if you bought the item today, this is the price. If you buy it later, it's going to be a higher price. Or if you buy it in another location, it's going to be a higher price. If you were to purchase it from today, you'd pay the lower price. The fact is that you're only paying him later. And when you're paying him later, you're paying him at the higher price. What it looks like, again, is that you're paying for the ability to delay payment. You're paying more because you don't have to pay till later. He says that's legal over here because the buyers here are garnering benefits that offset the higher price that they are paying. The higher price that they are paying, I'm still giving them enough benefit that it's really compensation for the benefit that I'm giving them. And that is the following. Rashi says, Mocher Pragmatia. He was a seller of merchandise. Haya Mocher b'makom azol, k'shar shu nimkar b'makom ayoker. He would sell it in a place where the market price was X. And then if you went to another location, you transported it to this other location, you could make more money. That was basically merchants of those days. The way that you made money was to import or export items from the cheaper locations to the more expensive locations. And the hope was that the cost of transporting it and moving to there did not exceed the value you would get in the other place. And therefore, it was worthwhile for you to transport it to go to the other place and sell it at the higher price. Rav Chama is charging them that higher price here and now. Right in that way, he says, you're paying the higher price. Umamtim lehen, he waits for them. Umalin le oto le makom ayoker. They go now and transport it to the higher price place. And then they sell it in the higher price place. So he is basically giving them the merchandise today at the higher price, but then he waits for payment until they have sold it in the higher price place, and then bring him the cash back. The reason it works is, Rashi says, the reason it works here is because he accepts responsibility for the item until it's sold. It remains his problem until it's sold. That is a big deal. It's such a big deal that if you go to Daf Ayin Gimel and Aleph, Rashi over there says otherwise, and the Balei Tosafot say, I can't believe Rashi said this. Rashi on Ayin Gimel and Aleph says that it's even when the buyers take responsibility in both directions. Here Rashi makes it clear that the person who sold it to them, to the buyers, is taking responsibility until they sell it. V'alukuchot mistakrim beprakmachesh lokrim sham b'ma'utav. And so therefore, these individuals make the profit when they go to this higher priced place, and then they bring it back, the cash back to him. The responsibility on the return is theirs. Since they don't take responsibility or basically possession of the item until it's sold or until they reach the higher price place, then it's not a loan because he's still on the hook for the item until it reaches the location where it's sold. Sale never is completed until they reach the higher price location. Therefore, there's no loan. This is the equivalent to the rental situation in which even when you're living there, the obligation to pay the rent is only at the end. So to over here, the obligation to pay for the Prakmatia is when it's sold or when it reaches the higher price location. If they don't sell it, then it becomes their problem as well. So then, on the way back, they are responsible. And now they have to pay the transport fees and everything else on the way. How come that's not considered to be interest? Because that delay of payment is basically that they have to now fork out the money for all the transportation and deal with all the costs of getting it to that location, bringing it back from that location. You're right, the sale is not effective until that point in time. So as far as on the way there, it's his problem. But on the way back, it's their problem. And they're still paying the transportation prices. So that means that in order to wait for the money, they're basically funding the transport to the higher priced location. So why isn't that considered to be interest now? If they're funding and undertaking the whole transport to get it to the higher priced location, and Rav Chama does nothing. He sits at home, and he gets the price as if he transported it to the higher price location, and he gets basically the benefit of the higher price without having to expend to get the higher price. Why is that mutar? In a normal case, you would transport it from the cheaper location to the higher price location, and you would benefit because your margin at the higher price location exceeds the cost of transportation. Over here, he's garnering the higher price without having to shell out anything for getting that higher price. So they're basically subsidizing him by transporting it, and then he gets the higher price. Or in essence, because of the delayed payment, he is garnering the benefit of their transport and all that they are investing to get it there. And it seems because of the delayed payment. Again, if they had cash today, they could buy it here at the lower market price and then transport it themselves to the other location and make the margin. Now instead, he's charging them the higher price. The reason, it seems, is because they have no cash and they're going to pay him at a later date. The reason it's not is for two reasons. One is that he accepts responsibility until it reaches location. So that means that until that point, it's still his. The sale doesn't take effect until they reach the higher price location. So that's number one. Number two is, even though on the way back they are responsible, and they are shelling out the cost of transport and all of that, they're still not a problem because he's offering them something in return. He is giving them a benefit in return, which is no taxes, and they get the priority in the sale, which means that the way that it is, nakadu shuka, means until they're sold out, nobody else is allowed to sell in the market merchandise. So these sellers get something from Chama. They get exclusivity, a tax-free sale. So that value is basically offsetting the benefit that he's getting for the transport that they're having. Well, the higher price is not an issue because he accepts responsibility until he reaches the location. The only thing they're really giving him is the efforts and the transport back and forth, which they're giving to him for free. That is offset by the value that he gives them back, which is exclusivity and the tax-free sale. So because of that, there's no interest charged here, because of the fact that both parties are gaining. There's a quid pro quo that makes it that he's not gaining anything. Rav Chama's tarsha that he says is mutar. Now, the Gemara says, first of all, the halacha is like Rav Chama, meaning that his tarsha is mutar. What is clear from the Gemara further on, as well as from even our Gemara itself, the halacha is definitely not like Rav Papa. Rav Papa's tarsha is problematic, because it's all from his perspective, not from the perspective of the buyers, and that's problematic. The question that is left over is, what about Rav Nachman? Is Rav Nachman tarsha mutar? So the Balei Tosfot say, Omer Rabbeinu Tam, Tehilchata Nami, Rav Nachman. The halacha is not only like Rav Chama, but also like Rav Nachman, Vitarsha. And the fact that it says here, Hilchata Rav Chama, it's not to tell you, not Rav Nachman, but Lafuke Rav Papa. It's to say to you that the Tarsha of Rav Chama works, but not that of Rav Papa. But that doesn't mean that Rav Nachman's Tarsha doesn't work. So the Balei Tosfot believe that the halacha is both like Rav Chama and like Rav Nachman. And Tosfot says here, the difference between Rav Nachman's Shita and Rav Papa and Rav Chama's Shita is that Ha'ainu D'ayim with the Rav Nachman lo shari ela b'delo katz. Rav Nachman, it says, don't ask, don't tell. Which is, as long as you don't give a price for it today and you just set the price for the future, that's fine. Rav Chama and Rav Papa, their Tarsha is even when the price is available today. And we know what the price is today, or we know what the price is in the cheaper location. Despite that fact, they still allow you to charge the higher price. And again, by Rav Papa, it's going to be a sur. By Rav Chama, it's going to be a mutar based on what we conclude here. What's interesting about this is that the Balei Tosafot, back on Samach Gimel Amud Bet, said that even if you don't say something, when the market price is well known, it's as if you said it. He said back there, if you discount something to the market price, even though you don't say, I'm discounting it to the market price, and you don't explicitly articulate it, he says there with the wax, when you gave him it for 5 for a zuz instead of 4 for a zuz, if it's well known that the market price today is 4 for a zuz, then when you give him 5 for a zuz, it's as if you're saying, well, if I pay today, you get 4 for a zuz. You pay later, it's 5 for a zuz, because the market price is well known. And what's interesting over here is Tosafot says Rav Nachman's Shita is premised on the fact that you don't say anything. So that would mean that Rav Nachman's Shita, according to the Balei Tosafot, is only true when there's not a widely or well-known market price. You can only set a future price when there's no available or apparent market price today. Because if there was available or apparent market price today, Tosafot considers that to be the equivalent of explicitly stating it, even though you don't say it. Because it's so well known, or since it's so widely available, it's the equivalent of you saying it. The Rif, the Rambam, the Ramban, all believe when the Gemara says Hilchotok Rav Chama, that means only Rav Chama, not Rav Papa and not Rav Nachman. The only Tarsha that is allowed is that of Rav Chama, where there's an offsetting value that is created there. It's not just this silent interest, like we say by Rav Nachman, if you don't tell, it's okay. The Hilchotok Rabbi Elazar, the Loch is like Rabbi Elazar from the machloka that we had between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar before. When you charge ribit tzutza, can Beit Din take it back? Do we force you to disgorge the profits? Rabbi Elazar said yes. Rabbi Yochanan said no. So we said halacha is like Rabbi Elazar, and we saw that throughout the Gemara, and we just saw that in the beginning of today's daf, that we do force the disgorgement of interest profits when it's ribit ksuta. Behilchata k'Rabbi Yanai, and the halacha is also like Rabbi Yanai, damar malihein, mali d'mehen. That is the case where if the guy buys it for forward delivery, if he purchases it for forward delivery, and either the market price is already well known or well set, or he has it in possession, then that is mutar, and he can deliver him in the end whatever he contracted for forward delivery. So if he buys from him wheat today at the current market price, and he delivers it at the future date, even though the price appreciates, it's fine, because either he has it in possession, and therefore it's as if the guy bought it already and it's appreciating in his possession, or he can go out into the market and buy it exactly at that price, so we deem it as if he's bought it already, and therefore it's appreciating in the hands of the buyer. That is allowed if you deliver the wheat in the end. Rabbi Yanai came along to say, you can deliver him wheat, or you can deliver him cash in the back end. It doesn't matter what you deliver him, because of the way that the transaction was structured, it doesn't matter what you deliver in the end. Whether you deliver wheat itself, or you deliver the market value of what it would cost to buy a bushel of wheat at that time, either of those deliveries is fine, and neither of them are considered to be ribit. Not the delivery of the merchandise, not the delivery of cash. We don't say that, oh, because you made it a cash payment, now it looks like ribit. No. Because the way it was structured up front, it's mutar no matter how you pay him in the back end. Whether you pay him what you're supposed to deliver, or you pay him the equivalent price of what you're supposed to deliver, that is mutar. So that's what the Gemara here concludes from the beginning till here, is that the halacha is like these three different opinions that we bumped into along the way. Machar lo et hasadeh, v'sold him a field, v'natan lo miktzat damim. And he paid him a portion of the purchase price. V'amar lo, eimatai shetirtzeh, havei ma'ot v'tulot shelcha. Whenever you want to make the remainder of the payment, come and make the payment, and I'll give you the property. Meaning that he withholds the entire property until he makes the final payment. So he pays him half of it now. Says, whenever you bring the other 50%, you can have the whole property. That is asur. Hilvau al sadehu, if he lent him with the field as collateral, v'amar lo, imi ata noten li mikan v'shloshanim, says, if you don't pay me back within 3 years for this loan, harihi shali, the field becomes mine. I mean, otherwise, the collateral will become the payment for the loan, or in lieu of the payment of the loan. Harihi shalo, that works. And that's what we saw before, that Baitus Ben Zonin used to structure transactions in this manner, and the Chachamim said that it was fine. That he used to lend them money with the field as collateral, and if they defaulted on the loan, then it became basically a purchase of the field. And that is mutar. Question is, mi ochel peirot. Who eats the fruits over here? Both in the Reisha case as well as in the Seifa case. Rav Huna amar mucher ochel peirot. The seller eats the fruits. Rav Hanan amar mishalshin et peirot. We put it into escrow. Velo plige, and they don't argue. Had amar l'chi maitit kani. The case of where we say that the mocher, the seller, gets to eat the fruits is in a case where he says when you bring the remainder of the money, that's when the sale goes through. It says the sale will be effective when you hand me the full purchase price. You only handed me 50% of the purchase price now. You want to get the sale to go through, give me the other 50%, and at that time, the sale will go through. That means that the property belongs to the seller until the buyer shows up with the remaining amount of money to get to the 100% of the purchase price. And that's why he's entitled to eat the peirot. On the other hand, Hadam Arlechi Maitid Kani Me'achshav. Ravanan, who says that you put it into escrow, is a case which says that when you bring the remainder of the money, that you retroactively own it from today. We're selling the field to you today. You paid for 50% of it. When you bring the other 50% of the purchase price, the sale would be of completed, or the effective date of the sale will be today. Right now when we're agreeing on this transaction. That means retroactively when the buyer shows up with the full purchase price, he owns the field from that moment. If that's the case, we have uncertainty as to who is the owner of the field. Is it the mocher, is it the seller, or is it the buyer? And that's why we put in an escrow to determine who gets the fruits once either the sale goes through, and then it belongs to the buyer, or the sale fails, and the seller really owned the field all the way along, and then he's entitled to the fruits that came off the field during that period of time. Now, obviously, if he doesn't come up with the remainder of the money, then he'll have to refund him the cash that he deposited up front because he never reaches the purchase price. So now the Gemara says, Tani Rav Safra be Ribit debrei Rabbi Chia. So Rav Safra brought down a braita from Rabbi Chia about Ribit. Pe'amim shishneim mutarim. There are times where both the seller and the buyer have rights to eat fruit. Pe'amim shishneim asurim. There are times where both of them are restricted from eating the fruits. Pe'amim shamocher mutar v'lokeach asur. Sometimes that the seller has the right to eat the fruits and the buyer does not. Pe'amim shalokeach mutar v'mocher asur. There are times where the buyer has the right to the fruits and the seller has no rights to the fruits. Ani Rava Batrei, Rava, after Rav Safra presented this, said right after him, I'll explain the Braita. What are the cases? The Braita just tells you that there are these different cases. Rava explicates and explains to you what exactly are those cases. Pe'amim shishneim mutarim. Where is the case where they're both mutar? Damarlei, kenei, kishiur zuzech. You acquire whatever you pay. So if he comes along with 50% of the purchase price, he keeps 50% of the property, and when he shows up at the other 50% of the purchase price, he'll get the remaining 50% of the property. So that means right now, where he handed him 50% of the purchase price, he owns 50% of the property. That 50% of the property that he owns, the buyer can eat the fruits from that. The other 50% of the property, which if he shows up with the cash, he'll buy, until he shows up with the cash, it's not his, and the mocher, the seller, can eat the fruits from that property. That is shnehem mutarim. Pamim sheshnehem asurim. The case where they're both asur is the case that we just brought from Rav Anan, which is Amalei, l'chimaitit knei me'akshav. When you show up with the money, you will buy the field retroactively to the effective date of this contract or of this sale. So that means that even if he shows up with the money in 6 months or 2 years from now, then the effective date of the sale is now, right today, even though he only pays in 2 years from now. But the problem is, in the interim, we don't know who the field belongs to. We don't know if he's going to show up with the full purchase price, and therefore it belongs to the buyer from today. Or is he going to default and not show up with the full purchase price, and therefore it belongs to the seller all along? Since we don't know, both of them are asur to take the fruits, and we put it in escrow for them until we figure out who is the owner of the property. Pe'amim mocher mutar v'lokeach asur. For sometimes when the seller has rights, and the lokeach has no rights to the fruit, damarlei, d'chimaitit k'nei. That's the case, again, that was brought by Rav Huna, which is the case where the transaction is only effective when he shows up at the full purchase price. The transaction only goes through once you paid the whole amount. So that means until he shows up with the full amount of cash, it belongs to the seller. That's why he can eat the fruits. The buyer doesn't own it until he shows up with all of the money. Until that point, it's not his, and therefore he cannot eat the fruits. And the last case of Pyamim Shalokeach Mutar, V'Mocher Asur, the case is where the Lokeach is Mutar. The buyer is mutar and the seller is asur. The amalei knei miachshav. The transaction is effective immediately. Zuzai lahavi halva'a gabeich. And then the money is an outstanding loan, and you owe me the money for the purchase that you just made. So that means that the buyer owns it immediately. The fruits are his to eat. The seller can't eat the fruits because it's not his property anymore. Now, when he shows up with the money, then it has no effect on the sale. The sale went through. The loan is what is outstanding. You have a quote-unquote mortgage or a loan outstanding now, but there is no repercussions to the sale from the loan. And technically, even if he defaults on the loan, then when the individual goes to confiscate the property in lieu of that payment, then it's a new transaction at that point. Or in essence, he is taking the property in lieu of the debt payment, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't own the property in the interim. So those are the four different permutations that the Braita brought, and Rava's explanation for each one of these. So, man tana shnehem asurim. Who is the author of this braita that says that both parties are asur here? Am Rav Huna b'rei Rav Yeshua, delo k'Rav Yehuda. That is against Rav Yehuda's position. D Rav Yehuda, because Rav Yehuda, who we bumped into before, says, ha'amar, tzad echad b'ribit mutar. That if there are two possible outcomes to a scenario, and in one scenario it'll be ribit, and the other scenario it'll be not ribit, it's not a problem, since at the outset of the transaction, it's not guaranteed that there will be interest over here. That's not considered to be ribit. In this scenario where the individual says, I am selling you the property, and it is effective date today when you show up with the full purchase price. So we said before in the Braita, and that's what Rava interpreted it, Shnei Masurim, they both can't eat it. The buyer can't eat it because maybe he'll never show up with the full purchase price, and it's the mocher's field. The mocher can't eat it because maybe the buyer will show up with the purchase price, and then the effective date is today, and retroactively he would have owned the field. That means that the mocher is eating the fruits despite the fact that the buyer owned the property, or in essence, he's eating the fruits because he lent them the money, or he delayed the need or the necessity for make payment on the field till later, and it's an effective interest. Rabbi Yehuda says that's not a problem, because there are two possible outcomes over here. One outcome is that the buyer defaults. If the buyer defaults and the mocher ate the fruits without any problem, he was entitled to eat the fruits. Okay, if the buyer does show up the purchase price, then he ate the fruits like interest. That is a binary outcome in which one outcome is interest, one outcome is not interest, and therefore it's not deemed to be interest according to Rabbi Yehuda. And so what Rav Huna Brei Rabbi Yeshua is saying is Rabbi Yehuda can't be the author of that braita. Mashkin lo bayit, mashkin lo sedeh. If he gave over a house as collateral, or he gave over a field as collateral, it would seem that this is a continuation of the braita of Tani Rav Safra, because the Gemara gives no opening indication that we are now speaking about a braita like Tanur Banan or Tanya, so that would seem to indicate it's a continuation of the previous braita of Tani Rav Safra. So if he gave over the house or the field as collateral, v'amar lo, likishet tirtze lemochram, when you want to sell them, lo timkareim elali b'damim alalu asur. He says that you have to now exclusively sell them to me at this price, asur. That is problematic. Now, the way that Rashi explains the transaction is that he says to him, psak lo damim mu'atim lo sif, alma'ot halva'ah, that's mital lo imbala mochra. He sets a little additional price on top of the loan to have him get the field. The person lent him money, and he defaults on the loan, or basically he's unable to make payment on the loan, and now he's going to sell the collateral in order to pay the loan. The deal is that if you sell that collateral, you must sell it to me. Now you're going to sell it to me for forgiveness of the loan, plus a small additional payment. That's the way Rashi terms it. The Bali and Tosafot don't understand why Rashi requires that extra payment. He says, Ubichinam Perushkein, Debalav Tosevet Damim Posikim Olahat Smitabi Yado, Imbala Machra, Glishid Chokoto Malvemi Mautav, Akorchach Yezakuk Liftota Olamachra, because the creditor can press him to force him into a sale position. So Rashi says that you have to incent the debtor to sell the field. The way that you incent him to sell the field is to pay him not only with the forgiveness of the loan, but also some additional compensation. And so that is the incentive or the hook to get him to sell it. Otherwise, why would he sell it for the forgiveness of the loan? On the other hand, the Bali Tosafot say that you don't need that incentive because the creditor holds the keys in his hands. The creditor can press the debtor for payment. And once he forces the debtor into a necessity to come up with the cash and make the payment, he'll be forced to sell the field to make the payment. So the malveh, the creditor, has that ability to turn the switch, basically. Even though he's not compensating the debtor to force the debtor into a sale position, he can simply do it by tightening the screws on the debtor. Therefore, Tosafot believes that it's not necessary to have that extra payment in there. So the Gemara says that is asur. Bishlov yehen mutar. If the price that they agreed to between them was some sort of discounted price, then it is problematic. On the other hand, if he says, when you go to sell it, I have exclusivity or first right to buy it, but I'll buy it at the then market price, that is mutar. The difference obviously being that if he buys it at market price, then he's getting no benefit for being the lender, except for the first right of refusal or the right to buy it at the market price. But that is not ridiculous because the item is a mashkon, is his collateral, and the other individual owes him money. So he's lending him money, and that is the collateral. And then if he buys it at market price, he's gaining no advantage because he was the lender, aside from the fact that he gets the first right. But his first right is only at the market price. On the other hand, if they set a fixed price up front, which is a discount to market, then his loan is actually garnering him the benefit of a cheaper purchase. And therefore, it's deemed to be interest because of the fact that he's buying it, or he will be able to buy it at a discounted price. And if he goes ahead and then buys it at the discounted price, that discount was a result of the loan that he extended, and therefore, it's deemed to be interest. So, man tana b'damim alalu asur. Who says when you do that at the discounted rate, it is asur? Am Rav Huna b'Rei Rabbi Yeshua, once again, the low Rabbi Yehuda. It cannot be authored by Rabbi Yehuda. Di Rabbi Yehuda amar tzadachad b'ribit mutar. Because once again, Rabbi Yehuda says that when there are multiple outcomes, and only one of those outcomes is repeat, then it is mutar. Over here, there are the different outcomes. One outcome is he never sells the property. If he never sells the property, you'll never get the benefit of the cheaper price that you agreed to, and there's no interest here. On the other hand, if he decides to sell the property, he's forced to sell the property, and he sells it at the lower price, then there is interest associated with it. But once again, at the outset of the transaction, it's not guaranteed that you will be end up with interest. There are different paths or different options. Since there are different options, that's called Sada Chad Beribit, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and therefore it is Mutar. So obviously he's not the author of this Braita, which would be consistent. If this is a continuation of that previous Braita, then once again, Rabbi Yehuda is not the author of the earlier part of the Braita. He's also not the author of this part of the Braita. And now we have one more scenario. Machar lo bait, machar lo sodeh. He sells him a house, or he sells him a field. V'amar lo. He says to him, kishuuli mat ma'ot, when I get money, hechzirim li. You're going to give him back to me? Asur. That is problematic. Likishiyulacha ma'ot, achzirim lecha mutar. When you have money, come to me and I'll give him back to you. The scenario is that you have a seller and a buyer. The seller comes along and sells this property to the buyer. Now, there are two statements here. One statement is made by the seller, one statement is made by the buyer. What the Braita says is, if the seller says, when I have money, I'm going to buy them back for you. Right. That is a stipulated condition of the sale, that when I have money, I'm going to buy them back from you. That is asur. If the buyer says, when you have the cash, come to me and I'll give them back to you, that is mutar. The Gemara will ask in a second, what is the difference? And again, here we say, mantana. Who is the author of this part of the Braita? It's really a continuation of that Braita. Amar Rav Huna, Braita Rav Shua, third time says, Galok Rav Yehuda. This can't be like Rav Yehuda. The Rav Yehuda, Amar Tzadachad Beribit, Mutar, because he said Tzadachad Beribit is Mutar, and here it's not guaranteed that there will be interest. The interest results from the fact that the individual, the seller over here, gives the buyer, in the interim, rights to use the property. He sold it to him. Therefore, in the interim, the individual is going to either live in his house, or he's going to use the field. Then the seller shows up with cash, and says, well, it was stipulated part of the transaction. When I have cash, you give it back to me. So the guy says, okay, he gives it back to him. What's the problem? In essence, what just happened was he lent him money. The buyer gave him money. He got the money back at a later date. And in the interim, he got to use the property. He used the field or the property. That means he basically got interest. So that's what the problem is. Now, for Rabbi Yehuda, it's not a problem because there are different scenarios or outcomes here. If the guy never shows up with the cash, there's no interest because you bought it from him. It's yours all the way along. There's no interest. If he does show up with the cash and he buys it back from you, then there's a problem of interest. That's Sada Chad Beribit, because you have different options as to what could happen here. Those different options make it, according to Yehuda, it's Sada Chad Beribit, and it's not considered to be interest. For the Chachamim who say Sada Chad Beribit is Asur, it's going to be Asur here. But then the Gemara says, Maishna Resha, Maishna Seifa. What is the difference between the case where the seller stipulates where it's Asur, and the buyer stipulates and it is mutar. Amarova seifa da amarle midate. The seifa is when he says it voluntarily. In essence, the difference is that when the seller stipulates it, he in a sense makes it a term of the contract. He makes it a term of the sale. Once you do that, then it's interest because he has a right to buy it back. His right to buy it back makes it then essentially a loan because he sold it at one price, buys it back at the exact same price. In the interim, you got to use the property. So it's deemed interest in the interim. And that's the problem. When the buyer makes the stipulation, the way that we say here, mi da'ate, which is Rashi says over here, im erze achzirem. He says, if I choose, I'll give him back to you. V'lo shetivani bedin. But you have no legal right over here. So the buyer says to him, look, when you get the money, come to me and I'll give it back to you. He does not make that a condition of the sale, but rather says, I'm a nice guy. If you show up the money, I'll give it back to you. But I'm under no obligation to give it back to you. If that's the case, then you can't call it a loan because he doesn't have to give it back. If he wants to sell it back to him, that's what he's doing at that point. He's selling it back to him. But he's saying to him, I'll sell it back to you at the price that I bought it. So he's being a nice guy and saying, if I want to, I'll sell it back to you. But that's exactly what it was. It was sold to me in the interim. And now I'm selling it back to you. But I owned it in the interim period. because I'm under no obligation to give it back. If he was under an obligation to give it back, then it starts to look like a loan rather than a sale and then another sale. And that's the problem in the first case, which is where it's stipulated part of the transaction, then it is a problem. Tosfot over here differentiates between this scenario and a case in which you have a mashkon below nechaita, which is that you take collateral and you use it without deducting any of the principal amount of the loan. So over there, Tosfot says it's different because lo dami the mashkanta no chaita, because hacha im lo yifte ein ze milve el mecher. If he does not redeem it, it's considered or classified as a sale and not a loan. On the other hand, with a mashkon, the mashkon remains a mashkon even after the passing of the debtor. Even his children can come and redeem the mashkon. They have a right to buy it back. So therefore, there it's always deemed a loan, and the mashkon is just taken as collateral, or then when you keep it, you are then utilizing a mashkon, which can be redeemed at any time. And that means that whatever you lent him in the meantime is always classified as a loan, versus over here where it's classified as a mecher, as a sale. And that's an important aspect here, which is that you have to classify this as a sale. If it's classified as a sale, and then when he buys it back, it's a new purchase, then it's fine. If stipulated condition is part of the original sale, that means that it's no longer a sale, but rather a loan, and then he's utilizing the field in the meantime, or it becomes collateral against that loan. And that's why it's problematic. But that is also why Rabbi Yehuda over here would say it's mutar, and by mashkanta below nechaita would say that it is asur. Because over here, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it's deemed a mecher because of the limited recourse that the seller has in order to buy it back. In the case of mashkanta, that remains permanently able to be redeemed by the debtor or any of his proxies, including his yorshim and so on and so forth. Therefore, there's never ever a sale that can deem it tzad echad biribit. All right, how gavra? The zavin le'ar lechavre shelo b'achrayut. This individual sold land to his friend without recourse. Chazia d'ha'akvi ka'otziv. The seller saw that the buyer was distraught or upset over this issue. Amalei amayatzavit. He says, why are you upset? Itarfu laminach. If my creditors come and take away the field from you, magvinalach shufrash bacho peri. I'll pay you for my edit, my best property. Not only will I reimburse you for the property, I'll reimburse you for the shevach, the appreciation in the property or the investment you made in the property and any of the production of the field. So I'll fully reimburse you. Amar meimar, pitume mila ba'almo. That is not binding in any way. That is simply a words of encouragement, words of consolation. It's after the sale. It's after everything has transpired. His promise at this time is just trying to calm down the buyer, but it's not a commitment inside of the transaction. Because, as Tosfot says, Dav kahocha shvar amdu al sof liknot shlo b'achrayut. That is only because the original transaction was completed without achrayut. And it was clearly said that there was no achrayut. Because if they do a transaction without anything being stipulated, it's considered to be a tod sofer, and it's as if there's achrayut in there. So it has to be that they clearly had a deal that said shlo b'achrayut, and now after the fact, when he tells them this, there's no mechanism for making it into a binding commitment because the transaction already transpired and the deal is done. Amalei Ravashi le'meimar taimamai. Why? Kevin de lokeach bailet nuye. Since it is the buyer who needs to make this stipulation, v'acha mocher kamatne, and instead it's the seller making the stipulation, that's why we say it's simply words of consolation, not a binding part of the agreement. And so as Tosfot clarifies, this is all when it is post-conclusion of the contract. Because obviously, if the terms are offered by either party while the negotiation is going on, they get sealed into the contract. This is only once they've come to an agreement and then it's added on afterwards. This is where the question of who makes the offer as to whether it's binding or not. Ela matznita diktani. What about the braita that we brought before? L'kishayudacha ma'ot. When you have money in the future, achzir lecha, I will give it back to you. Mutar. Then it is mutar. D'mocher hu d'bay le'etnuye. It is the seller there that should have made the condition. Mocher lo'atni. And the seller didn't make the condition. V'lokeach ka'amatne. And the buyer is saying it. V'aminan ma'ishna reisha u ma'ishna seifa. And over there we said, what was the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? V'amarava sefer d'amalei midate. The reason it's mutar in the sefer is because he said it voluntarily. Timer d'amalei midate, which means that he said it voluntarily, but not only did he say it voluntarily, it's up to him. He doesn't guarantee he's going to do it. Halo amalei midate. Had he not made it optional, meaning that it was extractable in court, lo amrinib tulei milu alma, we don't then say that it is tume alma. Why is that the case? Based on your reasoning over here, which is, whoever is the party that is supposed to make the condition, if the counterparty makes the condition, then it's nothing real. Over here, in the case, the buyer is the one should demand recourse. If it is the seller that is offering the recourse afterwards, that means that he's tume milma. He's just saying it to make the guy feel better, but he's not really giving him that option because he's not the one that needs to stipulate the condition. So too in our case over here, who is the one that should stipulate the condition of the right to rebuy the property back? It is the seller. So the seller is the one who should have stipulated it. Instead, it was the buyer who made the stipulation. That means that the failure or the reason that it should be binding is because the buyer is the one who said it. But that's not what Rava explained. Rava explained the reason that it's not a problem over here is because the buyer did it midate. It did it of his own volition and it was not enforceable in court. That's what made it that way. But why should that be? If he didn't say it voluntarily, if he did say it was enforceable in court, ama al korche mikayem tna'a. If it wasn't voluntarily done, but it was a part of the transaction, then he would be forced to keep the condition, and it wouldn't go through because it would be rebeat. Why? He's not the party that should be making the stipulation. So according to Rav, it shouldn't go through. So amalei, naseh kamanda amalei midate yitmar. Don't say it as if he did it voluntarily, or only when he says it in a manner that is not binding does it work, but rather, when he's the one who says it, it's as if it's non-binding. Why? Because it's tumei milta. It is this consolation type of statement, but it's not a real binding part of the agreement. If you want something to be binding in the agreement, the person who has to stipulate it is the one who's the beneficiary of that condition. If it's the other party who's saying it, he's just trying to make it nicer, improve the feeling of the party that's buying, but he's not guaranteeing anything. He's not giving you anything. And therefore, it's not considered to be a binding part of the agreement. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots in the top of Samach Vav, Amud Aleph.